We might just make a start. The door's still open at the back. Not sure how many more we're getting, but if we don't start soon, we'll run out of time for Alistair to do his wonderful presentation. Can I just introduce myself first? My name's Jeff Warner, and I'm the Product and Pricing Actuary at Australian Super. I'm proudly wearing my badge today. You can see on my pocket. A couple of housekeeping items just before we get Alistair to start up. First of all, the time allocation is 50 minutes. We're probably starting a little bit late as we are. Alice is going to speak for around 25 to 30 minutes, and after that we'll have about 20 minutes for, usually it's questions, but I think we'd like to call them discussion points, because I think with Alice's presentation he's going to ask more questions of you. All contributors, could you please just make sure you use the microphone that's in the centre of the room, because the session's being recorded. So please state your full name and where you're from as well, and if you don't, I'll jump on you. And the notes here say to speak clearly, so please make sure you do that. Also a reminder to complete the presenter feedback survey via FSF Connect. I've only just jumped on myself, so I know it works. And also to keep those tweets coming via Twitter at hashtag 2014FSF. And I'm told that as long as you get your tweets in before lunchtime tomorrow, they're still eligible for the lucky prize. So that means I get $100 like Naomi, because I've mentioned that. So let's move on to Alistair and his presentation entitled Super Risky, Managing Risk and Investment Strategy and Presenting Risk to Members. One of the longest titles of the concurrent sessions I see. A little bit about Alistair. Alistair joined Australian Super in 2008 and is responsible for portfolio construction, asset allocation strategy and portfolio control within the investment team at Australian Super. He is also involved in investment department strategy and research of new investment products and strategies. Prior to joining Australian Super, Alistair was an investment director at Hastings Funds Management, where he was responsible for developing portfolio construction and strategy, the implementation of infrastructure, timberland and other private market investments, and investment research. He also served on the board of directors of a number of investee companies. Alistair holds a Bachelor of Commerce, Honours in Finance and Actuarial Studies from the University of Melbourne, and is a Fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia. Please make Alistair feel welcome.
Thanks for the introduction. Try and whiz through a couple of points here, and as was mentioned at the start, I'll leave some time for discussion. If I can get this to work. Name on the screen.
Just click on that.
The joys of technology. I think when I set this topic, I think I actually got the punctuation wrong. So in the final presentation, I put super ... risky, and the risky is really the question mark, and it's really around the key issue and the key question which I'm asking in this presentation is, are we putting in place risk management practices which are in members' best interest? At the end of the day, that is the first and ultimately the only test we really should judge ourselves by. And my concern and my contention is that I don't think we're necessarily going down that track at this current point in time. And I'll look at three specific areas as to why that might be the case and areas that we might look to improve on. The first and I think the most important one is how we integrate investment strategy with measuring investment risk. Really important issue. Secondly, how we disclose investment risk to members. And this goes to the heart of something which Susan Thorpe was mentioning in her presentation this morning. And I think she covered it, you know, quite aptly, where she said that we need to inform people of crucial information. Secondly, talk about income, not wealth. And thirdly, help people understand options. And a lot of the information which I'll capture here today tries to get to the heart of those particular three issues that Susan was referring to. And finally, a couple of implications around product design, and I want to specifically touch on the issue of sequencing risk. I'll often talked about, but rarely well explained. Sorry. The interesting thing about how we integrate risk with investment strategies, based on our experience, there hasn't actually been any really useful direct precedents for us. We've searched the world, looked at defined benefit contribution schemes, defined contribution schemes, investment managers, looked at all the different kinds of risk systems that we could use to help us run the fund. And the reality is there aren't many direct precedents which directly apply to how we run an investment portfolio and how we look after members' savings in an Australian context. So that's a really important thing to measure, is there's no direct off-the-shelf solution that we've been able to see. So where we've had to come to was we needed to tailor our approach, make it fit for purpose, focused on what the key investment risks are that we're worried about. Secondly, consider our investment beliefs and how they impact how we measure risk. And finally, use data and models correctly. It's often usually put at the byline at the end of a presentation or a discussion, but it can't be underestimated how if you use data in the wrong way or use the wrong kind of data, you'll come up with completely wrong conclusions as far as investment risk is concerned. So, time frame is a very large and important part of how we think about risk. Many investors, and the way in which a lot of risk is presented, is anchored on short-term time frames. And the slide I've got here seeks to understand that a little bit further. The bar charts look at when a portfolio returns below its average, what is the cause of it? And what you would tend to see is that over a short-term time frame, the dominant cause is equities. And the example here I've given is for a 60-40 equity portfolio. But when you move to a 30-year time frame, the risk is actually around about approximate to the asset allocation. And the main reason for that is that we're looking at short-term volatility versus long-term impact on returns. And the concern I have, which is something which was discussed a little bit this morning, is that we're entering a market with low long-term interest rates. That's a low, you know, a very long-term risk, but potentially with equity volatility. So we immediately have two issues around risk, one which is entirely a long-term issue around low interest rates, but secondly, about how we reconcile short-term volatility. The interesting thing is that most risk models and most risk systems focus on the very left-hand side of this example and always refer to the fact that the equities are the dominant part of the risk. The reality is that's only the case when you look at it over the short-term time horizons. The second thing people often look at is market crashes, and this has been something which has been, you know, particularly made a lot of mention of in the last 4 or 5 years and is the source of a lot of regulation. This chart here is a little bit busy, but what it is the accumulation of returns over a period leading up to and after crises in the US, where those crises have led to a loss of more than 10% in the market in that year. So the zero line is effectively when a crisis starts, or around about when a crisis starts. The interesting thing is that the red line, being the global financial crisis, is actually not too far away from average in terms of the overall accumulation of wealth over that period of time. But the actual fall in the market was a little bit bigger. The interesting thing is, though, it's not a great deal different from a lot of the other crises that we've already seen. And there's over 10 up on this chart. But what people often forget is that in many cases, a significant amount of wealth is built up leading into the crisis. Now, often that is usually related to valuations. And what we see is actually paper gains, paper losses. So when we think about investment risk, charts like this are particularly important when we're talking about building people's wealth, because yes, the journey matters, but arguably it's more about the destination. And as long as people aren't triggering a sale of their portfolio at the bottom part of the market cycle, then it may not necessarily be an issue. And in fact, Matt, it may be an opportunity. That then leads us to the issue of how investment philosophy and measuring investment risk interact. And in my opinion, you can't actually separate the two. So on one hand, we can say, okay, let's have a static asset allocation. That then leads you down a path of saying you can either live with short-term volatility, you can de-risk assets to remove short-term volatility, or you can look at just the long term and ignore the short term volatility and leave a fairly aggressive asset allocation in place over time. Alternatively, you can look at a dynamic or some form of tactical asset allocation approach where you either seek to adjust the portfolio in a very short time horizon to manage sentiment, market cycles, any particular short-term downturn, or alternatively adjust based on a more medium-term approach which has regard to valuations in particular, but also economic cycles. Things where people might say, look, I know if there's a substantial risk of, you know, one of those sort of more than minus 10 type events, then you might actually be able to look for signals as to what the potential risk of those kind of crises occurring might be. But arguably, those are probably more based on a time horizon of 3 to 5 years based on something like valuations. The interesting thing is that every choice on this page, irrespective of whether it's static, short-term, long-term, dynamic, whichever choice you make, there are varying degrees of skill, cost and risk associated with them. The skill one is a really important to keep in mind, but also risk, particularly from a peer risk standpoint. In relation to skill, it's often said that there is, you know, a lot of skill associated with running a dynamic asset allocation process. My contention would be that it's better off trying to do that rather than necessarily putting one's head in the sand and going with a static approach. And I'll talk about the implications for what the long-term impact on members' returns might be if we don't actually try and add value in this respect. To focus a little bit on dynamic processes, and I've just got a couple of slides that walk through this. This is an interesting piece of research from the US by a chap named Mark Kritzman. And he looks at splitting return periods between what he refers to as turbulent and non-turbulent periods. And these are very, very short time frames. We're talking about measuring data on a daily basis and aggregating that over a period of a couple of months to determine whether markets are particularly risky or not. And what he found was that market returns are substantially different depending on whether things are volatile in the short term or not. The interesting thing is, though, that if you're going to capture returns from something like this or alternatively de-risk the portfolio, you have to be prepared to move the portfolio in substantial amounts very, very quickly. That requires transaction costs, that requires a lot of conviction, and it also presumes that there'll be times where you might actually get it wrong over a very short time frame. The data does suggest it can be done, but for a fund of, you know, a reasonable amount of size, moving assets in and out of equities over the course of 1 to 2 months may become quite impractical. The other way to look at it in the dynamic space is to look at it based on a 3 to 5 year view, and this is some analysis by Schroeder's, which looks at the conditional return distributions across 3 year periods based on whether valuations are deemed to be cheap or expensive. It shows that there's a considerable difference in returns over those time frames depending on where valuations start. This would probably be something more suited to the time frame over which most superannuation funds might be approaching their governance. However, it's important to note that there's a big assumption underlying any valuation-driven approach, and that is that you know the actual bounds of how expensive or cheap stocks can get. Now, arguably, if those bounds had been set prior to 1990, no one would have presumed that the US equity market could get to above 29 times or 26 times price to earnings multiple that it did. But the reality is it did. So there's a critical assumption that you know where you can draw the bounds. And the often said comment is that markets can stay cheap or expensive longer than anyone can actually hold their job. So there is a really very important underlying point here, but again, it does take a strong degree of conviction to be able to adjust a portfolio. As I mentioned at the start, the use of models and data requires a lot of planning and research and forward thought. And we think this is something which is often not thought about until the very end. You know, arguably, the model selection is done right at the back end of a process of establishing a risk system and an approach to measuring risk. However, the model choice depends solely, and I would say solely, on what the objectives are that people are trying to measure, the time horizon over which they're looking at it over, and the needs that they're looking for. And in particular, the frequency of the data can actually drive different outcomes. The level of detail which a lot of risk systems go into is probably not a level of detail that many super funds would be particularly interested in. Now, one example is if we look at a short-term model which may have been built for equity, so like a Barra model, for example. That's designed really to measure tracking error on a benchmark relative equity portfolio. It's not designed to measure the risk of a diversified portfolio that a superannuation fund might have. It's also not designed to measure the risk of the portfolio over a reasonable time horizon. It's optimized to work out stock-specific risk. It simply doesn't seek to measure the risks, which are the most important ones for funds, which will be where interest rates are in the cycle, how expensive are equities, what are my prospects for economic growth over the next 3 to 5 years. Those are probably the more important questions to be asking, not whether the marginal contribution from BHP or Rio is driving, you know, a particular part of the equity portfolio. The other important issue which we've found is dealing with unlisted and non-traded assets introduces a non-trivial and quite a complicated or unwanted issue in terms of how we approach risk modelling. In Australian Super's case, we have around about 25% of our assets in unlisted sectors, and you know, there's actually no great solution out there, unfortunately. If we try and proxy by listed markets, we get the risk of equity markets coming through, and those assets don't tend to behave like that. However, if we just use the valuation or appraisal series which those assets operate on, that's not an ideal outcome either, in a sense that the volatility of the assets is actually suppressed by that valuation cycle. So where we actually come to is we end up need to make assumptions about somewhere in between those two, because neither of those two solutions is an outcome which actually reflects the true risk of the portfolio. Moving on to the second key part of the presentation, and this is around disclosing risk to members. I've used this slide once or twice in a couple of presentations, but it does go back to something which Susan mentioned in the plenary before, which is if we lose sight of the longer-term outcome and the longer-term result, particularly when we're talking about what the income is that people will generate from their savings, then we've missed the entire point of what risk is about. And importantly, if we just chose to de-risk a portfolio, in this case I've just put, you know, CPI plus 2 rather than CPI plus 4, if we accepted a lower return, the only way we could get people back to around about the same level of post-retirement income is by doubling their contributions. Now, there are a number of funds who are probably in a situation where their employers might be able to increase members' contributions to a level which might actually be able to cover de-risking a portfolio. And that option of either going to a life cycle fund or moving to a sort of lower risk portfolio in a long-term sense might be available. The unfortunate reality is that for many of Australian Super's members, the only contributions they get are the superannuation guarantee contributions, and many of them, in fact the majority of them, don't make any voluntary contributions. So the reality is we have a choice between the green bar and the red bar. The blue bar isn't an option for most of our members, and many of them are in the low to middle income space as well. So their capacity to generate a reasonable retirement outcome cannot be necessarily made up from increasing contributions. This is a real interesting point which I'll probably leave for some discussion after I've finished around design of my super options, because we'll start to see some differentiation on the basis of the types of contributions and the amount of wealth members will be accumulating, because you'll see situations where funds do have the ability to make some choices around these things. Unfortunately, in our case, we probably don't have the luxury of relying on increased contributions. The other important thing around managing risk for members is, on average, our experience has been investment switching has been extremely costly. Now, this is painting the worst possible outcome, but the reality is that the biggest switching activity we saw as a fund was in the period from December through till around about February, March of 2009. So there's 3 or 4 months after the Lehman collapse, where people got their member statements and decided to leave our diversified options, go to cash, fixed income, capital guaranteed. By and large, a lot of them haven't come back. And what we've seen is that there's been a permanent impairment of capital, mainly because they couldn't stay the course through a market cycle. So our take on this is probably twofold. One is that if an option is too volatile for members to stay in it, it probably isn't doing its job. But secondly, if members make choices like this, it can undo decades worth of effort on our part. So there is a really critical point here around ensuring that when people are making choices, that we actually stop them making extremely harmful choices. So where does that leave us on disclosure? Ultimately, it's important in my mind to balance timeframes. And apologies for the font here, and I'll explain this a little bit further. We think it's important to have disclosure that goes to members which looks at time frame in particular. The standard risk measure that was proposed unfortunately doesn't get to that point. And in our disclosure we've sought to include both short, medium and long term risk in the measures that we provide to members in our disclosure. And for example, balanced is described notionally as high or medium to high risk on a short-term basis, predominantly because of the volatility of equities that I referred to before. But over the long term, we would say the risk of it not meeting, you know, inflation or an inflation plus objective is relatively low. Compared to cash, it's the exact opposite. And we think it's important to make some tangible steps on disclosure. And unfortunately, the standard risk measure and some of the disclosure in the product dashboards probably don't get to that point. Arguably, this is still a work in progress. There's still a substantial amount more that can be done. And the very positive thing about the standard risk measure is that we're having a conversation about what disclosure can be provided. The point is we need to actually get it to a point where it's both meaningful, but also it promotes the right kinds of decisions. Finally, implications for product design. One of the really interesting points is that, you know, we as a fund and all funds quote time-weighted returns to our members. You know, we say over the last 10 years we've delivered 7.5% or 8% or whatever the number is. The reality is there isn't a single member who actually gets the time-weighted return, because contributions and withdrawals change that return. So it's different for every single person. Impossible to communicate, but really relevant when we think about issues of life cycle investing and sequencing risk. We think that those two issues are, they're both wonderful terms, but unfortunately they've been misinterpreted. In the case of life cycle investing, and again I'm borrowing a little bit of work from Schroeder's here, the reality is that over most time frames, when back-tested, life cycle investing hasn't delivered a substantially better outcome than just holding a static asset allocation. And that's even through the last 10 to 15 years when we've had a significant normalisation in bonds in terms of bond yields and a significant amount of, you know, above average returns coming from bonds. And you would have expected that in a period where you had high going to low interest rates that life cycle investing should have been substantially better. The reality is it hasn't. So my concern with life cycle is it sounds intuitive, but it's not, based on the back testing, delivering substantially better outcomes. And these are over longer term time frames. My concern is that what life cycle investing is doing is reducing volatility to members without actually improving their net retirement outcome. When we think about sequencing risk, life cycle investing is trying to actually deal with the issue of sequencing risk. When we think about sequencing risk in the accumulation phase, the reality is that you can almost think of sequencing as a bit of a lottery. But the lottery is when you actually start saving and when you finish saving, not the actual sequence of returns. And the interesting point about it is, for most people, the sequencing is actually mostly to the upside in the case of equities. There aren't many people who actually do very, very poorly out of sequencing when you think about it over a 30 to 40 year period. And this is running some analysis with, you know, a $50,000 starting balance, $5,000 contributions, you know, over a 30 year period. There actually aren't too many people that do badly out of sequencing. It's just missing out on those really, really, really stellar periods when your wealth is at its highest point. But that then begs the question, what happens to people who are retiring and what does sequencing risk mean for them? It's a slightly different picture. And what this seeks to do is measure that the percentage of periods where a particular strategy doesn't meet the same return that you might have got in accumulation. So what this is really trying to measure is if someone accidentally were to cash out at the wrong time in markets because they're in the decumulation phase, how much worse is it than had they just been in accumulation? The interesting thing is that the contribution rate needs to be above probably 3.5% before it becomes a material issue, before people are actually cashing out an amount at which their chances of actually not meeting the longer-term return is diminished substantially. The interesting thing to note about this chart is that these are percentages of a starting balance increasing with inflation. So if people were just looking for a constant amount of income over time, the chances of having a worse outcome than having no withdrawal would be substantially better. So we think the issue of sequencing risk is probably quite overblown in a sense that for most people who are on the minimum withdrawal rate under the accumulated pension, there's probably not a substantially great difference in terms of them likely to sort of have a permanent loss of capital from withdrawing from the market. And the main reason for that is actually quite simple, which is it's less than the income which is coming off the portfolio. They're not actually selling their assets until they get to a much later point in their life. So withdrawal rate is actually the most critical issue. But if you can push out that withdrawal rate, or in this case this is an example of someone who's 10 years prior to withdrawal, on the blue line, that amount of sequencing is diminished quite substantially. So, as I mentioned at the start, the key question which I wonder about is, are we putting in place risk management practices that are in members' best interests? There's been a lot of push from regulators, governments, policymakers around increasing the amount of scrutiny we have about how we measure risk. My concern is that it is potentially going against what is in members' best interest. In particular, is it clear about what kinds of risks it's trying to measure? Is it focused on the kind of risks the super system should be worried about? Secondly, is it ignoring what are commonly observed, quite simple investment principles about how market cycles operate? Secondly, are people using the right kinds of models to measure it? Are they using things which are too short in terms of time frame? Are they trying to measure risks which simply won't matter at an overall fund level? Are we guiding members to appropriate choices? And finally, is product design being guided by proper analysis or just by what seems to make good intuitive sense? My contention is that the intuition is potentially what helps sell investment product, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's the best retirement outcome for members. Finally, and I'll leave this as my concluding comment before we open up to questions, my suspicion is that funds' responses to some of these questions will be quite different. I don't expect that every single fund should have the same answer to all of these questions, and they should be considering how their member demographics are different, and in terms of the contribution rates, in terms of the withdrawal rates, in terms of the amount of wealth they've got, the claim on the age pension they have, because a lot of those things will actually change the way they answer these questions. And it will be refreshing, I hope, to see continued differentiation such as we've seen with MySuper in terms of, you know, people taking a different track based on their actual member demographics. With that, I'm happy to open up to questions.
Thanks very much, Alistair. Just looking at the clock, we've probably got about 15 minutes for questions, so I'll throw it open to the floor. If anyone's got one, please step up to the mic. And while everyone's thinking about a question, I'll throw one at Alistair myself. You threw a lot of different ideas in there about how we should be looking at risk, de-risking, my super, life cycle funds. But I think what we really, the big elephant in the room is, what implication does this have for post-retirement products? I know that's a pretty broad question, but discussion point, should I say.
Well, I think, as I mentioned, and it was a bit, apologies for the death by PowerPoint, but in relation to post-retirement, it's quite clear that it's different from accumulation. I mean, it's very clear in a sense that people are withdrawing, they're not accumulating. So that does change the way in which we need to approach how we measure risk, but importantly how we communicate it to members. So to give you an example, in the modelling we think about for post-retirement products, and in some of the disclosure which we provide to members in our pension member booklet, it focuses on how long they'll be able to draw an income for. You know, as an example, rather than talking about how much of an accumulated balance they might have, it's really about, you know, how long might it run for. So, for example, it will look at what's the withdrawal rate, what's the investment strategy you're going in, and what's the range of outcomes you might expect. So if it's an equity option, the average amount of years that it might last for might be longer, but the reality is that the dispersion around it is substantially longer, and you know, in effect, you end up having to say that there's some sort of health warning around any investment option in the post-retirement phase, where if you have a combination of a volatile strategy and a higher withdrawal rate, then there is a substantial risk that you have a permanent loss of capital and an inability to recover. And that for me is the most important principle, is particularly in a member choice environment, to explain to people that you do have to consider the two together. And if you do that, then you've got a much better chance of people having something which is meeting their expectations.
I was hoping you'd have the answer.
more product development.
Naomi? Mm.
I don't need a mic. Oh, you think I do need a mic?
It's been recorded.
Oh. Thank you for that very interesting discussion. With the super fund that I chair, we have a lower CPI target for the My Super Fund than you guys do. Mm. It's only, I think it's 3.5%, not 4%. And kind of from your slide, it's like, well, why would you do that? You'd obviously have, you know, 4%, or why not 5%? Because, you know, members can't catch up, blah, blah, blah. And I think in passing, you kind of mentioned, of course, if you have, you know, a lot of volatility in a few really bad years, members may make a very bad decision. And I guess one of the reasons why you might target a lower and less volatile strategy for those My Super people is that we do observe that they can and do and have make very bad decisions as soon as they see volatility. And so I was just interested in how you kind of educate and manage around that. And I really like Aus Super's 3 buckets of risk. You know, different time frames. I think that's way better than what's on the dashboard at the moment. But I was interested in what kind of thing you do when you have members who are so scared of volatility, you know, other than the kind of education.
It's a substantial challenge, not least of which because a lot of our members are not necessarily the most financially literate, compared to, say, Uni Super, for example, where a substantial amount of their membership are, you know, university professors and will be quite well educated about these things. It's a real challenge. And the difficulty I find is, contrary to what was said in the prior plenary, things are not particularly volatile at the moment. It's actually incorrect. Volatility is actually quite low relative to history right now, and I actually am always surprised when market commentators talk about how risky things are in respect of market volatility, because it's usually incorrect. So one of the biggest challenges we have is actually a lot of the investment community can't even get its story straight. So how do we get that done? And then what do we do when we talk to members? Because if we can't get our own story straight, it's very difficult to have a coherent conversation with members. The one thing which we try and always instill with people is, if you've made a choice, make it over the right time horizon and stick with it. As a general rule, switching activity, as I've said before, has generally been pretty poor on average. Arguably, there needs to be some form of a disincentive towards switching activity to potentially prevent some of that. Certainly, I absolutely agree with you that how we manage the journey for people, if we disenfranchise people along the way, then we won't have achieved the goal. So in respect of what inflation target or inflation plus type target we might want to have, I think we're arguing over 0.5% here. But the critical concern we have probably around that target is we're probably coming to a point now where a lot of the asset consulting fraternity is starting to question whether or not a CPI plus 3 or 4 type target can be maintained in the current environment. And that's probably my concern, is that particular aspect probably hasn't been challenged up until probably 12 or 18 months, the last 12 or 18 months. And particularly with the low interest rate environment, that is probably one of the biggest concerns we have about longer term risk.
Okay, I'm Richard Weatherhead, Australian Super. So I should know the answers to all your slides, Alistair. I'm interested in your comments about sequencing risk, and the question that came into my mind is, if you're able to get into the heads of all members and ask them the question about, for example, are they intending to take their retirement funds as a lump sum or as an income? And if it's an income, are they going to withdraw a small amount or a large amount to use their funds up over a shorter or longer period of time? If you're able to have that conversation with the member, would you then think of a product strategy which involves a different design for each of those groups of members? And if I think about it as two extreme buckets of members, would you think that a target date fund type approach, like in the US, even though it's discredited there, might be a good approach for those that have got a set point in time where they want to take their lump sum? I agree 100% with your analysis that a long-term diversified portfolio soaking up all the volatility in the meantime is the right thing for the long-term investor with relatively low withdrawals. But I'm just interested in your views about if you could have that conversation with each member, would you tailor your product designs according to the desires of each member?
I think in simple terms, if you could have that conversation, the answer is yes, quite obviously. And one of the reasons why we have kept our My Super option as a single option through the accumulation phase is not because we necessarily hate a life cycle option as a strategy. The issue is that we think it fundamentally de-risks people too early. What de-risking should be focused on is about taking people out of the market before their withdrawal rate gets too high. And I think that gets to your point, which is it's about when you use the money, not about how old you are. And that's been one of our main concerns. So one of the reasons why our default option doesn't de-risk until retirement is it de-risks when the withdrawal rate, the minimum withdrawal rate required under the pension rules, gets to a point at which the sequencing risk will occur. But there is, as you mentioned, a really important point to note here is that, there are times when people have lumpy amounts of capital expenditure, and if you know when those are coming and you know a bit more about people's withdrawal habits, then you can design a better option. the reality is, at the moment for us, the lion's share of people withdraw the minimum. And that's just how it is at the moment.
Anybody else? I've lost my mic.
Alison, Grant Haas at Maritime Super. So we've got a similar sort of membership profile to you in the sense of being quite blue collar and uneducated. And we certainly saw the switching profile that you talked about. Unfortunately, through the GFC, we've analysed every switch back to 2006, and through the GFC, some of the members actually got in early enough and got back in soon enough to actually have one in the strict sense of where they're better off staying where they were removed.
You employed them?
Subsequent to that, of course, every subsequent crisis, they've stuffed it up completely, you know, and the wins are in the teens. But our issue is really, how do we overcome the media swamping of the media hysteria about a drop in the markets? You know, we try all the techniques and all the logical responses, and I think, you almost wonder whether there isn't an opportunity for someone as big as Aussie, who's really going to be the competitor of the retail funds, to try and get hold of the journalists and educate the journalists about how to portray these sort of market events. Because it seems like individually we're having trouble getting to our own members. But
yeah. Look, there's no doubt in the issue of market volatility needs reframing. I didn't refer to it much before, but the reality is there's so many times in history where countries default and economies collapse, and the frequency of them probably hasn't increased a great deal over the last 100 years. The problem is we have everyone speculating about what's going to happen, you know, minute in, minute out, or, you know, nanoseconds these days with our friends in the high frequency trading. So the problem is there's all this much more news, but no new more economic events which actually impact members' outcomes. You know, the reality is if Greece implodes, it will do it. You know, as Argentina has done 8 times over the last 100 years, you know, these events happen with about the same rhythm. But look, there's no doubt that I think, you know, it's something which, you know, funds are going to have to take more of a leadership on. One of my concerns was the second biggest amount of switching activity we had was not related to the markets tailing off. It was actually relating to the Greek crisis. In the first kind of, you know, June period of 2011. So it was relating to news, not markets. And that was popular media spooking people. It wasn't a reaction to a market event. So, and that was concerning in a sense that the problem is not just a reactionary event, it's people thinking, oh, well, there was this thing happening a couple of years ago, it's going to happen again, I need to get out. You know, the reality is that every central bank in the world did everything they could to avoid the scenario, and most of us had some sense of that might be going on. So more has to be done.
Okay, I heard the bell go 5 minutes ago, which meant we had 5 minutes, so that should say it's up. Also, the doors have swung open at the back, so I think people are moving to other sessions. Okay. So it just remains for me just to, on behalf of you all, to thank Alistair for his fantastic presentation, insightful as always. And could you acknowledge it in the usual way?